If you are looking for even more help and guidance on your breakup, I have a few different options for you to take your healing to the next level. I have 4 different online courses depending on what stage of the breakup that you're in, from beginning all the way into moving on after heartbreak. Or you can bundle all of my courses together and use the code PODCAST to get $25 off my course bundle. I also have my 30-day no contact challenge to help hold you accountable in going no contact with your ex. And we have our free Facebook group, Healing Hearts Club, where you can connect with other people going through breakups all over the world. To learn more about any of these resources, head to the show notes where you can learn more about my courses, take the quiz to figure out which course is best for you, or join the Facebook group. And don't forget to use the code PODCAST to get $25 off my course bundle. Welcome to the Heal Your Heartbreak podcast with your host, Breakup Bestie, aka me, Kendra. Breakups are hard, but you don't have to do it alone. Each week, I will be taking you through a different topic as it relates to breaking up, healing from heartbreak, growing in your single life, dating, and getting back into happier and healthier relationships. The goal of this show is to provide support, hope, tips, and to remind you that above all, this too shall pass. Welcome back to another expert episode of the podcast. Today was one of my favorite interviews that I've done in a long time. Today I'm talking to Thais Gibson. She has a PhD in over 13 certifications in modalities such as CBT, NLP, somatic experiencing, internal family systems, and shadow work. She has nearly a decade of experience running a successful private practice and engaging with over 30,000 clients through individual sessions, workshops, and an educational platform. She runs the personal development school that has thousands and thousands of members. She talks more about it in the episode, but there's a variety of courses, peer support groups, daily events within this school, something I'm, as someone not going through a breakup, 100% wants to check out. So today we're talking about a lot of different things, but we talk about attachment styles in a way that I know I've had other attachment experts on the show. I really loved her take on it and how she was able to articulate them. We talk a lot about the subconscious mind and how it needs to be reprogrammed when we have a core wound that we're experiencing. We talk about how to reprogram that. We talk about the different things that happen within a breakup or within grief, this idea of why breakups can be so traumatizing and so hurtful to us, which I loved. We talk about her take on the healing process of healing from a breakup. And we also talk about this idea of limerence, which is something that I've been hearing more and more about. But we talk about what is it, like how it can impact people and how to overcome it. So I loved this episode. I love her take on healing and this idea of tapping into our subconscious in order to heal instead of just relying on our conscious mind. So loved talking to Thais. I hope everyone is able to connect with her. And here she is. Welcome, Thais, to the Heal Your Heartbreak podcast. Very excited to have you on today and talk about a new topic that we haven't really talked about on the show yet. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Excited to be here with you.
I always like to start off mainly because I'm just very interested in how people get into what they do. But can you share a little bit about what led you to, you know, where you are now and like the topics that you've decided to focus on?
Yeah, I got really into a lot of this stuff, probably technically at a young age. Like I grew up in a family that was very like sort of broken home, lots of like really kind of chaotic experiences, really messy divorce that my parents went through. And I was definitely parentified as a child. So I was definitely the child who was sort of emotionally soothing my parents, and they would both kind of vent to me about different things, about each other. And I grew up kind of in the middle of that. But strangely enough, I don't think I minded it in its own way. Like for sure, there were times where it was exhausting. I'm definitely not recommending that that's like a healthy parenting strategy for anybody. But I think at a young age, I just got really interested in human behavior and why people do the things they do and why people who really love each other and care for each other can be in this space of having so much challenge. And why can't there just be like an easier, better way? So by the time I was like 15 years old, I started going through my own struggles, definitely from internalizing a lot of that stuff. and a lot of my own journey to healing and understanding about my attachment style, understanding about my own subconscious mind and why I do what I do at that age was so beneficial to my whole healing process. So that was sort of the journey, and then ran a very busy client-based practice for the better part of 10 years, and then retired that about 4 or 5 years ago and moved into all of the online programs. And yeah, that's sort of the story.
That's amazing. I mean, I feel like you must have been, I guess, relatively early to the whole attachment theory thing. I felt like I think I've first, my friend handed me the book Attached probably 10 years ago. And I remember not a lot of people talking about it then. So, I mean, I know it's been around since, how long has it been around? A long time?
Yeah, for like decades and decades.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So I feel like you're still pretty like early into that. And I think it's such a great frame of reference to be able to see ourselves in relationally. And, you know, we've had other people talk about attachment theory on the podcast, but for those that maybe this is their first time kind of running through it, can you go through kind of quickly the four types of
yeah,
attachments?
Definitely. Definitely. So it originally started with John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth. And what we actually did, so my background became, I started in hypnotherapy because I learned that if you want to really change, we actually have to learn to reprogram our subconscious and unconscious mind, because your conscious mind is responsible for 3 to 5% of your beliefs and thoughts and emotions and actions. And your subconscious and unconscious collectively are 95 to 97%. And so for me, as somebody who's actually going through a lot of my own struggles, it was like, well, how do you change? And so we learned about attachment theory, like first year university and psych classes, you know, I went to school for psychology, and it was so surface level. Like it was like really just scratching the surface, where it was like, these are the four attachment styles and here's kind of how they come about. And it was never about how can we recondition our attachment style. And it wasn't too much about how these things really impact our relationships now. So that was sort of like the body of work that I went into in client practice first, was how do we change our attachment style? How do we actually become securely attached? So the four styles are, number one, securely attached. And the secure attachment style basically gets a lot of approach-oriented behaviors in childhood. So that means that a caregiver will go towards them a lot. And if they are crying, they'll be soothed. If they are expressing needs, the needs will be met. Boundaries are respected. Communication is encouraged. And so this child grows up as an adult to feel like I'm worthy of love, because I've been conditioned to see that I can get love just for my existence whenever I'm in distress. I am safe to communicate my needs. It's safe to rely on other people and to trust them. And I can negotiate needs and I can have healthy boundaries. And so they learn a lot of these really functional behaviors for adult relationships. The three insecurely attached styles learn a various degree of dysfunctional behaviors. And so on one kind of end of the continuum, in a sense, we have the anxious attachment style. And this attachment style basically grows up with either real or perceived abandonment. And so it perceived abandonment can really look like having very loving caregivers, but maybe they travel all the time for work, or maybe one caregiver is really warm and the other is more cold. And so this child grows up basically thinking, okay, like my love is going to be taken away at any time. It's like love is there and it's taken away. Love is there and it's taken away. So as adults, they become the individuals who fear terribly being abandoned in relationships. And they're always kind of assuming it and waiting for the other shoe to drop. And they also have big core wounds around being excluded, disliked, rejected, not good enough, and unsafe. They really struggle with uncertainty in relationships, and that can be very triggering for them. And of course, as a result of all of this, they'll try really hard to maintain closeness and hold on tight to their partners and relationships. On the flip side, we have the dismissive avoidant. Dismissive avoidant attachment styles grow up with an overarching theme of childhood emotional neglect, where they're trying to attach, and we're all biologically wired for attachment. But there's essentially this dynamic of going, I want this closeness, but I can't seem to get it no matter what I do. And so they decide, well, I'm going to adapt to this by just rejecting the need for closeness overall. And so they have this big fear of getting too close to people and being engulfed in that or enmeshed in that, and then feeling like it's just about the other person's needs and not their own. And they've long suppressed the ability to communicate their needs. So they grew up as adults to be like, I need space, don't get too close. And they constantly keep people at arm's length. And then last but not least, we have the fearful avoidant or disorganized attachment style, often referred to as those two different names, but it is the same thing. And fearful avoidant attachment styles share in the anxious side and the avoidant side. So they have some really good experiences with love where they fear it being taken away, But they also have some really painful or overwhelming experiences with love, where they fear closeness because it's been hurtful. And generally, they grew up in a household where there's a lot of chaos. It can be a bad divorce, a parent who's an alcoholic or addict, physical abuse, sexual trauma, any of those sorts of things. And basically, they fear closeness, but they yearn for it at the same time. It's like they have the conflicting associations about the same thing. And so as adults, they're like, come get close, come get close. And then someone gets close and they're like, get back.
Yeah.
And so they're like the pendulum always swinging. This is what I was. I did a lot of work on my own attachment style.
Okay.
And, you know, I was honestly like, I just, when I look back to prior relationships, prior to doing a lot of work and meeting my husband, in that distant past life of mine, I was probably so difficult to be with. I would like be giving mixed messages all the time, wanting closeness as soon as closeness was there, pushing back, and you constantly just flip-flop in your own mind and frame of reference all day, which is personally exhausting and obviously difficult for somebody on the other end as well. So those are the four main styles.
I love that. It's so funny. I don't know if I've just haven't been like explored the attachment styles in a long time, but that one specifically was very impactful just to hear and kind of run through. The fact that you said perceived abandonment for anxious attachment style, because that was me. I have an anxious attachment style, or at least I did. And it was because my parents traveled for work. Because I always would say, like, my parents were, they didn't abandon me. They were always like, you know, they were very loving and stuff, but they both traveled for work and worked a ton. So I feel like that was validating for me to be able to hear. I feel like I've just anecdotally always felt like your attachment style could change, because I was like a textbook anxious attachment style person for a long time. And I've been in a relationship for a really long time and feel extremely secure within the relationship. But I do sometimes still have anxious stuff come up around friendships. When I have like a new friendship, I like am so scared that I'm going to lose it, or I'm going to do something to mess it up. Or I still have that thing where if my friends become friends with each other, I just think that they're going to like conspire and then leave me out of it. You know, I still have those kind of thoughts. So can you talk a little bit about that idea of not having to stay in the box, and we're not, you know, doomed forever to stay in our attachment box?
Absolutely. And that's like the really crucial part of all of this, is that you're not born with an attachment style. It gets conditioned into you over time. And so when we look at like how the subconscious really absorbs its conditioning and its environment, it's repetition and emotion is what fires and wires neural pathways. So we create these whole neural networks. If you constantly, like even in your amazing share, it's like, okay, parents go and they travel. And so funnily enough, small T trauma, things that distress us and that we can't emotionally process, if it's repetitive enough over time, has basically the same impact as big T trauma. So you can go through this repetitive experience as a child of like wanting that closeness, and it's being taken away. And if that happens all the time, then of course, that's going to create the same sort of wiring that you would see in somebody with a parent who, you know, literally abandons the child. And so repetition and emotion are those two ingredients that really create that conditioning pattern. And so because we know that, we can leverage how we get conditioned and programmed at a subconscious level to recondition or reprogram these same neural networks. And I'm happy to like dive into tools for how to do that, because there's some really cool stuff. But one thing that you said that was so interesting is the conspiring against you and then you're going to be left out. The anxious core wounds are not just abandonment and fear of being alone, but also fear of being not good enough, disliked, rejected, and excluded is such a big core wound for anxious
attachment
styles. When
you said excluded, I was like, oh my gosh, that's so, I suffer with that a lot with friendships. I mean, I think, you know, I don't know if it's linked to like that idea of people pleasing, but I've always had really bad fear of missing out. I will like push myself to the limits to try to be at everything so I don't get that exclusion. So that's a big one that I don't think I ever really connected to my attachment style.
Yeah. And so it comes like these things tend to go really, really hand in hand. And these will be the sensitivities. And it comes for sure from a people-pleasing element, but also because more anxious-leaning individuals tend to derive a lot more of their sense of self and self-esteem from their relationships. Mm-hmm. Whereas you'll see like dismissive avoidance and fearful avoidance derive their sense of identity from different places in varying ways. And so there will be more of a sense of like, oh my gosh, I'm feeling like I'm losing a part of myself if I'm not in this area with these needs being met. And so that's where there's that big sensitivity.
That makes total sense. And I want to make sure, I mean, I love talking about this, but I do want to make sure I'm centering it around breakups, since that is the audience we're talking to. So what are some I guess, core wounds that get really triggered as we're talking about specifically a breakup or a loss of a relationship, divorce?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So this usually is honestly broken down by attachment style, because basically how a core wound works is we have these subconscious pre-existing neural networks and conditioned ideas that then are dormant until they get touched. And as soon as they get
Okay.
touched, they really sting. And you can imagine, like, if you were to take, for example, somebody who's anxiously attached and somebody doesn't call them back, they're going to probably jump to, like, oh my gosh, I'm abandoned, or I'm not good enough. Or, whereas if you take a dismissive avoidant who somebody doesn't call them back, they're going to be like, I am free.
Yeah.
they're going to be like, thank goodness I don't have to talk on the phone. So, it's really about, like, more the subjective wounds, but the really common ones you'll see that hurt the most, and I can actually share by attachment style, is anxious
Yeah.
attachments. Obviously, I will be abandoned. I'm abandoned. They usually take to heart, like, I'm unloved or not good enough or rejected, or I'll be alone forever is such a big one. And so these are really important things to reprogram. It's a big part of breakup healing for sure, is like reconditioning these core wounds can just speed up that process. And then fearful avoidance, they often fear a lot of those same things because they share in those wounds, but they tend to have really big trust wounds and unworthiness wounds and I am bad core wounds. So they fear that, oh, what if I'm seeming like the bad person? Or, what if I wasn't worthy and that's why this didn't work out? Or, wow, this person probably betrayed me. I can never trust somebody again. And so those are really important ones for the fearful avoidant to be working on. And then dismissive avoidance, they still assign core wound meaning to breakups, and they'll often make it mean that they are defective. And that's such a big pain point for them. And then they also fear, like, okay, well, in the future, what if I get hurt again? I don't want to be vulnerable and trapped in the wrong relationship. And they can have this deep sense of, like, being emotionally unsafe to really connect, which, although they may not feel that in a breakup, they can make the breakup hurt more because they project that into the future, right? If you feel
That
like it's so
totally makes
hard to
sense.
connect exactly and open up, then it feels hard, like proper relationships are far and few between. And so it can make us actually long for our ex even longer if we're assigning that meaning to the breakup itself.
That makes so much sense. And I also think it's important to point out that these dormant neural pathways that we have can be why your people's reaction to a breakup can seem so extreme. I know people who feel very emotionally well managed and feel pretty good about how they're able to cope with things. And then a breakup hits and it's just completely devastating. It makes sense that it would be because it's triggered this dormant core wound that hasn't really surfaced for a long time.
And that's exactly what it is. And that's why people tend to respond. So there's a couple core things that tend to happen after a breakup. One is we have the core wounds triggered, and that makes all the difference. That's going to be like, hey, now that these core wounds are triggered, I'm not just feeling the breakup, I'm feeling the breakup plus years of suffering that's just been sitting there and being stored beneath the surface. And our subconscious mind stores everything. It consolidates memories and experiences over time, but, like, we have a lot of emotional storage there. So when the core wounds, or if multiple core wounds get triggered, that's why people can just get so stuck in the grief and often have a hard time climbing out of it. And the second big piece is when we look at grief. So I had a big part of my practice when I was working with people was actually around working with death and loss for a period of time. So actual grief. And it's interesting because when we lose somebody out of a relationship, it doesn't change too much. Like, we're still grieving. And this is a really morbid example. I haven't found a better way of articulating this yet. But if you imagine, like, death and you think of loss of, like, a person, so God forbid, but let's say that, like, a family member dies, okay? So let's say Bob's family member dies. So let's say one of his parents. If he could take his parents' body and put it in his room and the physical form was still there, it doesn't help him grieve, right? So we have to ask ourselves the question, well, then what are we grieving? It's not the physical form. It's all invisible things that we grieve after the loss of a relationship. And so what we're grieving is the needs somebody brought into our life and who we got to express ourselves as, or who we became, what traits we expressed ourselves as when we were in the company of that person. And the same patterns are what are mirrored after a breakup. So when we're grieving, Or grieving, oh, this person met my need to feel seen or empowered or protected or important. And so what grief actually is the void that's left behind when our subconscious mind has been used to relying on a certain person to get our needs met over and over again. That person exits, they're now gone, and they take how our subconscious is used to getting our needs met with them. And it takes us quite a while to adapt to getting our needs met in new forms. But you'll see us attempt to do this because you'll see that usually when we go through a breakup, what do? Spend more time with friends or family or watch romantic comedy movies or all these different things that are us trying to reach out and get needs met in different forms. But until that those very specific voids have been filled of what needs were there, we will continue to stay around in that grieving process. And I worked with a period of time, this is like a very trigger warning thing, but I worked with, you know, grief in a multitude of cases. And in some particular cases, it was parents who had lost children. And one of the things that they would grieve the absolute most was actually less the needs that the child met, but more the second part of what we talked about, which was more the traits that they were expressing as a parent. And if you look at it, it's like these very sacred things. You're contributing, you're protecting, you're showing up with so much pure and unconditional love. And when a child comes into your life, you get to tap into those parts of yourself even more. And so grief is really made up, in my opinion, of three major facets. And it is the core wounds being triggered, the needs that somebody was meeting that are now seemingly stripped away until we can change forms and get them met in new forms, and the parts of ourselves that we mourn because of who we got to be or how we got to express when somebody was in our life. And when that's gone, that void is also left there behind.
That's so interesting to hear it in that way. I mean, the third part specifically, I think it makes so much sense as you're saying it. And I'm like, how is this not talked about more in particular with breakups? Is I feel like that probably lends itself to why a breakup will always just feel so personal, because it is taking, it's okay, this relationship brought this out in me and that made someone leave. So therefore, this is about me, even if it's very clearly not, where it's like, you know, in my case, hey, you want to get married and have kids. I don't want to get married and have kids. So I'm going to exit the relationship. But it still feels like, oh, it's just something that I did. And I actually see that a lot. Sometimes I tell people who are fresh out of a breakup not to dive right into their attachment style, just because I'm like, I feel like I see people say, oh my gosh, it was my anxious attachment style that drove this person away, or they'll automatically make it this thing that they did wrong. But that third part's really interesting on, I think, why we can take breakups so, so personally.
Yeah. And I think to your point, it's so interesting because one thing that anxious attachment styles do more than anybody, and I'm constantly calling people out in our school about this, like our students and stuff, they take all the blame. They're like, it was my fault. And they see, because the anxious attachment puts everybody on a pedestal a lot of the time or so easily, then you're in the pit. And so then, of course, you're taking the blame. And so I think that it's important. Like, I find attachment style work to be so healing because we can reprogram our core wounds and learn to meet our own needs and like become secure. And that is very healing after a breakup or a really hard life event. But if we dive in and then we do what you're saying, right, where we're like, oh, it's because of my attachment style, the relationship broke up, and we take all that blame, then that's just like so self defeating for people.
Yeah. So my next question on this would be, do you recommend like a particular order of, I don't like to use the word fixing, but I guess healing those different, like those three different parts of grief? Like, should you heal the part that the relationship brought out in you first, or, and then do the core wound at the very end? Like, is there a method that you recommend with that?
Yeah, it's such a great question. So I put together a course on this, and it's like, how do you go through a breakup? And basically what we do is we go through those exact steps for the course. So it's based on like grief work I did with people over the years. And it was like, wow, this needs to be packaged and accessible to people. So you start by like finding the core wounds, which is really like, what do you make the breakup mean about you? What are those different patterns of thought? And there's like the core wound sheet, right? Some of the core wounds we've been talking about, like, oh, I can't trust, or I'm abandoned, or I'm excluded, or not good enough. And then what we do is we plug it into a tool called auto-suggestion. I can actually share that tool if you'd like.
Yeah.
So auto-suggestion, it's basically how to reprogram your subconscious mind and get rid of these limiting beliefs. And when you look at things like affirmations, they're kind of futile in my opinion, because you're just using your conscious mind to speak to your conscious mind, because the conscious mind speaks language and the subconscious speaks emotion and imagery. So if I say to you, whatever you do, do not think of the pink elephant, like your brain probably flashed an image of a pink elephant.
100%.
Your conscious mind speaks language and yours do not, but your subconscious just speaks in emotions and images. So it sees the images. So what we have to be able to do is recognize, like, when we have these wounds, these are not conscious choices, because if they were, we would not be choosing them. Nobody's like, oh, I'm going to wake up today and tell myself 400 times that I'm going to be abandoned. So we have to deal with the problem at the subconscious level, because that's where it exists. And so how do we speak to our subconscious mind? Well, we speak through emotion and imagery, and we have to fire and wire. So we need repetition. So now that we know this, all we do is we take the core belief. Once we found it, I'll be abandoned, alone, et cetera. We find its opposite in step one. So I'll be abandoned, I'm worthy of connection, or I'm unlovable, I'm lovable. I'll be betrayed, I will have loyalty, or I can trust. So we take the core wound and find its opposite, step one. Step two, we find 10 memories of times that we felt this way. The reason we pick memories is because guess what memories are? A bunch of emotions and images. If you were to say your favorite childhood memory and you were like, I was playing on the playground, you would see the images of the slide. And as you're telling the story, you would start smiling. And that's what everybody does when they're recounting memories. So we just need 10 memories, because that's the repetition. And then the memories are a series of emotions and images. And research shows it takes 21 days to create new neural networks that are strong enough that they can really outweigh those old ones. And so we go, okay, core wound and its opposite, step one. Step two, find 10 memories of times I was good enough, or know I was worthy of love, or was connected instead of abandoned. And then we record them and we listen back to that for 21 days. And that has the power to actually rewire these things so they don't have to keep coming back, and then we're not healing these wounds all the time. And so when we can do that
Wow.
after a breakup is the first step, we can get that like sludge of all of our relationship wounding and baggage out of the way. And then what we do is step two, we go into like, what needs was this person meeting in the relationship? And I write them all out. And we have this like whole needs reference sheet where it lists all the different types of needs: protected, supported, empathized with, seen, heard, like all these big needs. And we come up with strategies for how to meet those in relationship to self and through other healthy sources in our life, friends and family, how to advocate for those needs more. That starts filling up that void of grief quicker. And then we get to look at, well, what traits did I get to express? Who did I get to become when I
Yeah.
was in this relationship? And then how can I practice still honoring those aspects of myself, even though I'm not doing that with this person any longer? And when we target those things kind of in that order, that tends to be the fastest, most efficient output to healing.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. As someone going through a breakup, you are carrying around a lot of big stressors right now. And as you hear me talk about on this show, those stressors aren't something that you can stuff down and just hope they go away. If you ignore your heartbreak or ignore general stress in your life, it can begin to weigh on you and affect you in a number of ways. Therapy is a great way to begin processing those feelings you're carrying around and have someone to stay current with when it comes to thoughts, fears, and stressors. You don't want this heartbreak to weigh on you forever, and you don't want it coming up in future relationships. It's so important to process through what is on your heart. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/heartbreak today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/heartbreak.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That's incredible. It makes so much sense. And that's, I mean, I'm not going through a breakup, but I feel like I want to just be able to go through that with different core wounds. Because I do think the who did I become within the relationship is, or what traits was I able to express with this person is a really important part. I know for me, that's why after certain breakups, I was left feeling like the quote unquote shell of a person, because it felt like it took, and not even just characteristics. I use this example all the time, but like hobbies that the person introduced me to. So I always use the example of hiking. I loved hiking with a particular ex, and I thought to myself, okay, this person took that away with them, which obviously is not true, but it really does feel like that at the time. So being able to restore that side of yourself also makes so much sense.
Exactly. And it's like, that's why it hurts so badly, is because we are literally, we feel like we are missing parts of ourselves. So we take it to heart because it literally feels like our identity kind of falls apart with the breakup sometimes, particularly in those long relationships where there's a lot of long-term dynamics to it. And so it makes sense for people that we should grieve. I think sometimes people give themselves such a hard time and then they blame or shame themselves for their grieving process. And it's like, oh my gosh, we should be self-compassionate and kind, because there's a reason we're feeling this way.
Yeah. And that's why too, people, you know, it's not asked so much anymore, but in the beginning it was, give me the time frame of how long it's going to take to get over this person. And you just never know how a breakup is going to trigger something like a core wound, or you just never really know how deep a breakup wound is going to go. And there are some that people are able to seemingly get through very easily. And then there are some that feel like they really wipe a person out for a year plus. And I mean, this makes a lot of sense as to why that happens.
Yeah. And sometimes it's because they're either not doing the actual subconscious reprogramming part. So that wound is just like left open, right? All of that unresolved stuff from childhood, or that they're so focused on like the wound part that they've forgotten about the needs and traits part. Mm-hmm. And so they don't access that. And so it feels like I'm trying so hard to get the needle to move on my healing, but there's usually these missing kind of peripheral pieces that are not being solved for.
This might be a weird question, but you know how they say that like the ego really tries to protect itself and it doesn't want to be like thought about necessarily. Yeah. Is that something like, I just noticed so many people when going through the breakup, it seems as though they're focusing on so many different other things to kind of distract themselves. Is there a thing that the core wound kind of doesn't want to be focused on? So it tries to hyper-focus on closure or why the breakup happened or what my ex is up to. And it doesn't, we don't want to look at that.
It's like such a good question. There's kind of three parts to it. Okay. It's such an interesting topic. So the first part is like, I often use the ego mind from like sort of that spiritual egoic perspective versus the subconscious mind interchangeably.
Okay.
Yeah. Because it's our programmed, right? And so that's really like, they go hand in hand, kind of just expressed through different forms. So the subconscious mind, aka ego, from a spiritual perspective, not Freudian perspective, right? Because that's, And so that aspect of self, it really wants to maintain its comfort zone, because the subconscious mind equates familiarity to safety and thus survival. And so we're like, okay, well, maybe I'm in pain, but I'm surviving. So whatever I'm doing is working. So we resist change. So that's the first part, is that we'll want to hold on to that identity. And that's why like learning to recondition the subconscious is so much more valuable and like helps fast track the process. Cause sometimes we can get so stuck in trying to like outwill our subconscious, but it doesn't really work like that. So that's the first part. The second part is that we can get really fixated on external things if that's what we're familiar with. So we can be like, oh, I need to know what my ex is doing. And usually what that actually is, you know how we talked about that second part of healing the breakup is meeting your unmet needs. Yeah. Usually it's just to meet a need for certainty. And so what we can do is be like, well, actually you just need certainty. And you can get that met in healthier forms rather than knowing what's happening with your ex. So oftentimes we're looking for a need met through a form that we were used to, because we were used to getting the need met through our ex. But instead it's like, okay, well, I can create my own certainty by knowing all the reasons this relationship wasn't going to work out for me and having certainty in new relationships around me in healthier ways. And so we can sort of do that way of doing things, and that helps to move the needle. And then the other part too is that sometimes we can get into relationship dynamics with individuals where we don't want to let them go because we don't realize that we are feeling like what we're really missing is those lost parts of ourselves. And so we want to make sure it's like, okay, well, we're so externally focused because we're trying to derive our sense of self through this person still. And the subconscious mind will go to its most recent forms. And this is the really crazy part is that when we can't get our needs met in the present, the subconscious mind will revert to getting its needs met through memories of the past or fantasies of the future. Because when we think of these things, they create an emotional response and it simulates to us like we're getting a need met. So we may obsess about somebody and the past because it makes us feel like, oh yeah, or we may obsess about them coming back. And what we're actually obsessing about, if you look at the fantasy really, is like, oh, they come back and they make me feel seen and heard again. They make me feel like I'm important. And we're not even necessarily aching for the person, we're aching for the needs. And so when we can see what's happening in the fantasy or in the old memories and unpackage that, like kind of break it down and be like, oh, well, what are the needs happening in the memories or in the fantasy? Oh, okay, that's telling me what needs I'm really in lack in right now. And then start fast tracking that process. We heal way quicker.
That makes so much sense. And it also makes sense as to why, on some level, people would prefer to hang on to a version of their ex that's not there. Or, I mean, maybe like, oh, I'll be friends with my ex and hear them talk about other people that they're dating, even though it's destroying me. But I'd rather have that than have to let go of that completely and see what's underneath. And I guess that maybe leads me to the thing that I was going to talk to you about in the beginning. And then just, I got everything else you're talking about so interesting. But does this tie into that idea of limerence and, you know, having that obsession of something that's not there?
That's exactly what it is.
Okay.
So limerence itself, right? So limerence, for anybody who's not familiar, it's basically this obsessive infatuation with somebody. And it's different from a crush in that the emotional intensity varies, the frequency of how much we focus on it varies, and the degree that we will self-abandon and sort of people-please outside of ourselves as a fixation to get closer to our object of limerence or the person we're like obsessing over are much stronger than like a traditional crush or developing feelings. And so limerence actually exists along a continuum, right? We can have like low level limerence where we're, you know, we're so nervous around somebody we can't eat, or we dream about them at night. And there is like a certain degree of obsession and kind of euphoria associated with it. But then we can get all the way down to like, I worked with people who I was, you know, in the past who I was concerned, like, is this stalking? Like, we're really entering into stalking territory where limerence can be so fixated on the fantasy world with somebody that we actually totally lose the reality. Like, I had this one client, he was showing up constantly to like drop off things at this woman's house that he'd been on two dates with, who rejected him after the second date because she represented such a deep need that he was hungering for, that he attached so strongly to the need in the fantasy, he couldn't see her in the reality. And so that's what limerence really is when we get so obsessively infatuated, and limerence can be a big part of like post-breakup. When we get so obsessively infatuated with somebody, it's actually that we're infatuating with the needs and the traits. And so we are like, oh, like I had this other woman. So she came into one of our programs and we do these like live things where people can come in and talk. And she shared that she was about to get married. She came into the personal development school to like work on, you know, premarital stuff to get prepared to make this investment. And then she came into one of our webinars being like, it was like her second week in the school. And she was like, I'm thinking of leaving my fiance. I met somebody at the coffee shop this week. And I was like, what? And she'd been with her fiance for like 5 years. And I was like, what do you mean? And she said, oh, you know, it was love at first sight. And she was like, what happened is this person, and she had expressed in the week prior that her fiance made her feel very unseen and unheard. And this person in the coffee shop, she spilled her coffee, dropped her keys on the floor. And this person came and like mopped up the coffee and picked up her keys and was super present with her. And she felt so seen and so heard and so cared for in this very like intimate way. And this trait, she felt like she got to be so present back with somebody and sort of express that side of herself. Now, interestingly enough, and this is these are the grounds or the roots of limerence, in her childhood, guess what she hungered for the most her entire childhood?
To be seen.
It was Exactly. Yeah. So she had been aching for this for so long. This one stranger who she knows nothing else about except for this 5-minute interaction in the coffee shop. And now she's trying to like find where he is and how to find him again. And she's thinking of leaving her fiance for this person. We will take these little instantaneous moments from somebody. And if that person represents those really big needs, that's where we will project onto them, build a whole rich fantasy world with the future of this person. Not even see the person. You know, people who are the object of limerence will often report feeling like really misunderstood and unseen by the other person. And it's because we create this fantasy world where we are making this attempt to get those needs met, to get those traits expressed within ourselves because we're starving for them internally. And so limerence will not just be the reason that until we do that work, right, that we may have actual like sabotage to our relationships because we're not ourselves when we're in limerence. We can't even like act normally. But it's also one of the biggest reasons people cheat in relationships because they feel like their needs are not met over here in the main relationship. The subconscious mind is a needs meeting machine and it will start like seeking outside. And if somebody comes along and represents those needs, people will become extremely preoccupied with that and really deeply infatuated. It can almost mirror like an addiction. And so what it's telling us and what's really cool is that the way out of limerence is to just find what those needs are and those traits are and learn to build those in relationship to self. And you can actually save marriages from cheating or long-term relationships from cheating by finding out those needs and then bringing those and expressing them into your partnerships. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff there happening beneath the surface.
I loved what you said, that the subconscious is a needs meeting machine. That's what it's programmed to do that. And I can see how there is a risk or a danger to not even knowing your needs and not having like an inventory of what are my needs? Are they being met? Because it can drive us into behaviors that feel inexplicable. But, you know, it sounds like if we kind of dig down into it, they are very easily explained.
Exactly. And like, that's the part that is so sad is that I would have people like come in and have discussions with me and say things like, yeah, like I'm such a jerk. I'm thinking of cheating or I'm like infatuated with somebody else outside of my relationship. What's wrong with me? And the first thing I always tell people is like, don't be hard on yourself. This is feedback. And so find out what it is over here. And before you're thinking of leaving a relationship, go to your partner with these things and these asks and these requirements and learn to harness these things and nourish these things in yourself. And if you can do that, what you see time and time and time again is that people end up being like, wow, I'm actually, this was a catalyst. And I actually learned what those needs were, what those traits were, brought them into my relationship with my partner or with myself. And I was better off for it. And my relationship grew dramatically and evolved into a much better space because I just did the work around it. But when we don't know that that's happening, people stray in relationships. They beat themselves up. They do all these things. They, you know, the family gets torn apart for some people. I mean, it can have a huge onset of consequences, but it really is about that, like, our subconscious is wired to get these needs met. And we have to use these experiences as the feedback they are to nourish these things in ourselves and relationships more deeply.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And going back to what you were saying about emotion and repetition is the way to reprogram. I'm just thinking of someone who does have the anxious attachment style where going to their partner with their needs feels very scary, but just being able to like do it and have a good experience with it and continue to do that, I assume will like build up that confidence and make it feel a lot less scary as time goes.
Exactly. And the more we can reprogram our wounds first, the less we fear communicating. So a lot of why anxious attachment styles are so afraid to share their needs is because they're like, I'm going to be a burden, then I'm going to get abandoned. And so when we start to reprogram those core ideas about ourselves, we realize, wait, without this idea, I realize that like it makes logical sense for me to be in a relationship where my needs will be met. And that's what I should be looking for. And so I better start communicating that. And that makes room for our relationships to evolve. If we were with somebody who was like, no, I'm never going to meet your needs, then we have to be like, well, is that really the relationship I want to be in the rest of my life? Like, is that really a healthy spot to be? And so doing that reprogramming on the core wounds first helps us often feel more confident and safe to then communicate the needs next.
Yeah, because I feel like even if you heard that from someone of like, I'm not going to be able to meet your needs, but you still have that core wound, the core wound is more powerful than our, I mean, like you said, what, 95% of it is our subconscious and like 5% is our conscious. So 5% can't compete with 95.
Exactly.
Wow. This is so fascinating. I feel like I really want to go join one of your programs. As we're wrapping up, can you share a little bit about your programs and how people can work with you and connect with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have different programs. You can go into the school and there's like different programs for what you're focusing on, like becoming securely attached based on your attachment style, or healing from a breakup, or overcoming limerence. Like there's all these different online courses. And then we have daily events with the program. So you can come in, I'm in there 3 days a week, answering questions, working with people. And then we have other facilitators who are in there. So there's like 6 day a week support and peer support groups, all these things to create that sort of community and network. And that's at personaldevelopmentschool.com/free trial. We have a full free trial. Amazing. We're doing okay. For the next few months. So people can jump in there, check it out, and then see if it's a good fit for them as well. And I'm also on YouTube at personaldevelopmentschool-Thais Gibson.
Amazing. Well, Thais, this was so good and so fascinating. I'm really, really enjoyed this conversation and excited for other people to connect with you too in that way.
Thank you so much. This was so fun. And thank you so, so much for having me.
You're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed today's show. If you loved it, I hope you'll leave a review and share with your friends. If you're not already following me on Instagram, head to @yourbreakupbestie, where I'm sharing new content almost every day. To join our Facebook group, Healing Hearts Club, where you can connect with thousands of people from all over the world going through breakups, head to the link in the show notes. And don't forget to check out my online courses for more in-depth help through your healing journey. I always end these episodes the same way, reminding you to be nice to yourself, stay connected with loved ones, and the biggest reminder is that this too shall pass. I promise.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.